We're in a series that we started last week. This is part two, called Lost. Does anybody here ever watch the old TV show called Lost? It was really popular in the early 2000s. So if you're born in the 2000s, you're like, what in the world is that? I have no idea what you're talking about. But Lost was a popular TV show in the early 2000s. Basically, the premise of the show was that there's a whole bunch of strangers on a plane together flying somewhere over the Pacific. And the plane goes down, it crashes. Sure, a bunch of people die, but there's a bunch of people who survive. And they end up on this island together. And they're lost on this island. And the whole premise of the show is that they're trying to get off this island. They're trying to get back home. So they're physically lost. But as you watch the show, as you dove into the show, they weren't just physically lost. Actually, the show would dive individually into each character's story. Each episode would focus in on one character. And as you learned their personal stories, you found out that they weren't just physically lost, but they were just lost in life. Every single character was lost in life. Last week when we started this series, it's based upon Luke chapter 15. The whole premise of Luke 15 is the fact that Jesus is spending time with all sorts of different people. And some of the people that he's spending time with would be considered the outcasts of society. They'd be considered sinners. The religious leaders of the time, those that were really serious about their Bible and serious about their faith, were looking at Jesus going, what are you doing, Jesus? Why are you spending time with these people? These are the wrong type of people you should be spending time with. And so he goes into a series of parables or stories to communicate his heart, why he's doing this, and to communicate the heart of God. And the first two parables that I talked about last week was the parable of the lost sheep and the lost coin. If you've never read those, I encourage you to go to Luke 15 and read those. And out of these two parables, there's two lessons that we got that are very, very specific to these parables. One is God values each person. God values each person. When you read those parables, it's very, very obvious that how God values people isn't based upon what religion you are, whether you're a Christian or not. It isn't based upon how good you are, the good things that you've done. It's not based upon anything other than the fact that you are a human being, you are an image bearer of God, and he values you. Plain and simple. Plain and simple, he values you. The second thing that we see in those parables is how heaven celebrates each person's that are found by God. And out of this parable, you get the sense that as human beings, we tend to wander away from our relationship with God, who he is. And that God is out searching for us. He wants to have a relationship with us. And when he does find us, that heaven celebrates. There's this huge celebration. I want to take you into the next parable that Jesus taught. Incredibly important parable. Probably one of the most important parables Jesus ever taught. I'm going to read it to you. It's like 20 verses. Can you hang with me? Okay, it says this. To illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, I want my share of your estate now before you die. So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. A few days later, his younger son packed all his belongings and moved to a distant land where he wasted all his money in wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land and began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry, I almost said hangry, probably that too, right? that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him. But no one gave him anything. When he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, "At home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare. And here I am dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, 'Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant.' So he returned home to his father, and while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son and embraced him and kissed him. His son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son.' But his father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring, put it on his finger, and sandals for his feet. Kill the calf we've been fattening. We will celebrate with a feast. For the son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found.' So the party began. Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard music and dancing in the house, and he asked one of the servants, 'What was going on?' 'Your brother is back,' he was told, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf. We're celebrating because of his safe return.' The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him, but he replied, 'All these years, I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me. And all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back after squandering your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the fattened calf.' His father said to him, 'Look, dear son, you've always stayed by me and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate this happy day, for your brother was dead, has come back to life. He was lost, but now he is found.'" This story is oftentimes called the story of the lost son or the story of the prodigal son. I actually think the label that we put on it is probably wrong, because it shouldn't be called the story of the lost son. Should actually be called the story of the lost sons. Because there's actually two parts to this story, and our focus tends to be on the younger son. That's where the emphasis is. But this older son that we read about at the end of the story, he is lost as well. These two sons, I think, represent all of us to some degree. They both have their own struggles. They're both actually away from their father properly. They're out of relationship with their father in reality. They're both lost. And I think all of us represent to some degree these two sons, and the father represents God. Jesus uses the younger and elder brothers to portray two basic ways people try to find happiness and fulfillment. There's two basic ways that people try and find happiness and fulfillment. Number one, the way of self-discovery. This is the younger brother. He's looking for his truth in life. He's looking for his self-discovery in life. He's looking to find his happiness in life by going his own direction of self-discovery. And then there's the way of the older brother. This is the way of moral conformity. He's just as lost as the younger brother in reality. But he's trying to find his fulfillment, his happiness through moral conformity. Both of these ways actually disregard God and see God as being in the way. Today, I'm actually going to be looking at number one, the way of self-discovery. If you come next week, I'm going to be looking at the way of moral conformity. The way of self-discovery. It's interesting, you know, this idea of inheriting the estate. 2,000 years ago in the time of Israel, when Jesus lived, they wouldn't get their inheritance until the father died. And the way it would work is if you are the oldest son, you would get 2/3 of the estate and everybody else would get a third. So if you had like 7 kids or whatever, the first would get 2/3 and everybody else would get like the leftovers. That's the way the culture was. In this situation, there's only 2 sons. There's the older who's going to get 2/3, there's the younger. And so the younger wants his third of the estate. He wants his third. The interesting thing about this story is that the dad isn't dead yet. And he comes to his dad and he says, I don't want to wait until you die. I want my money now. Now, I think in our culture, that would be incredibly rude. But in this culture, 2,000 years ago, it was terrible. He's coming to his dad and he's basically saying, I wish that you were dead. I wish that you were dead. Give me what I want now. He sees his father as a means to an end. He values the money. He doesn't value his father. Give me what is mine. The son doesn't want to be held down by his father's ways. He wants to do his own thing. Do you know that in traditional Middle Eastern culture, when they would have heard this 2,000 years ago, do you know what the average man would have been thinking? It is the father's right to now get up and beat that son and kick him out of the house and disown him. So the people that are listening to Jesus 2,000 years ago, that is what they're thinking. They're hearing this story, and the first thing that's going through their mind is, give that son his beating. I mean, they don't care. The kid could have been 20 years old. That father's going to beat him. Kick him out of the house and disown him. And that would have been the father's right to do that because of what he's asking for. And yet in this story, the father doesn't do that, does he? I mean, the people listening to Jesus at that time would have been shocked. They're going, what in the world? What in the world? When he's getting 1/3 of the estate, this isn't the father liquidating his RRSPs, going down to the bank and pulling out his savings and giving him cash. It wouldn't have been like that. When he's asking for a third of the estate, it's talking about property. It's talking about land. It's talking about animals. For the father to be able to give the inheritance to the son, he would have literally had to have taken 1/3 of his property and sell it off. This would have been property that would have been handed down to him generation after generation and generation. And the son is saying, I want you to sell that off. That property that was given to you by your father, I'm not interested in it. I just want the money. Sell it off and give it to me. I mean, this would have been incredibly shocking to the hearers. So the son finally gets the money. He takes off to a foreign land, lives incredibly wild, blows his cash. It seems like at the end of the story, it's like the older son knows a little bit what's going on. He's like, he's been blowing his money on prostitutes and whatever. I mean, he's living a wild life. He runs out of money. There's a famine in the land that he's living in. He ends up going to work for a local farmer. He's feeding pigs. Now, for the people of that time, they would have been disgusted by that. These are Jewish people. They didn't eat pork. They didn't get around pigs. They didn't touch pigs. So when they're hearing this story about him feeding pigs, they're thinking, you're disgusting. That's like the lowest of the low. He's not making enough money. He's hungry. He wants to eat the food that the pigs are eating. It talks about the pods. It talks about the pods. These pods are referring to a very specific tree that grows in the Middle East. It's called the carob tree. And the carob tree, there's sometimes trees around here that's like this. Have you ever seen a tree that grows like, it almost looks like really long peas? They're really, really big, and they go brown. And they eventually fall off the tree. Those are the carob pods. And they would take those carob pods and they'd feed them to the pigs because humans wouldn't eat it. humans would only go to that stage if they were starving. They'd take the carob pods, they'd take the peas out of the carob pods, they would roast them and they would eat them if they were starving. But generally, they just take those carob pods and they give them to the pigs. They'd feed them to the pigs. So this younger son, he's wanting to eat these carob pods. He's tending the pigs. And finally, he's like, what am I doing? He knows enough about his dad that he thinks to himself, if I just go back and I'm going to be like, I'm not your son. Can I be like one of your hired men? Maybe you can apprentice me out. This is kind of the conversation that's going on in his mind. This is what he would say to his father. He'd say, Father, I know I don't have the right to come back into the family. But if you apprentice me to one of your hired men so I can learn a trade and earn a wage, then I can pay off my debt. That's what he's thinking. In Middle Eastern culture of this time, a verbal apology wouldn't have been enough. Jewish rabbis would tell the local people that when you're asking for forgiveness, there needs to be restitution as well. So you can imagine he's asking to go back to his father, and he's saying, I'm not asking to be back in the family, but would you forgive me enough to be able to be one of these hired men? Maybe I can learn a trade from them, and I'm going to slowly pay you back. That's what he's thinking in his mind. And so he goes home and he's thinking through, okay, the words that I'm going to say, how am I going to say this to dad as he's walking down the road? You can imagine the dad's on his front porch and he sees this man walking down the road and he recognizes him as his son. And he runs out, the story says he runs out to the son. Now, this would have been shocking to them as well because in the Middle East 2,000 years ago, they didn't wear pants or shorts like you and me. They wore robes, right? You've seen the old movies. And so for the father to run, he would have had to like hike up his robes. Can you imagine? Like it's like a woman hiking up her dress, right? And he's got sandals on and he's running down. His robes hiked up. It's actually like within the culture of that would have been like really embarrassing. He's not being very honorable in doing this. Hiking up his robes. It's not very dignified. And he runs out to his son, and you can imagine he wraps his arms around him. And before the son can get out his lines, he's forgiving the son. The son doesn't have an opportunity to grovel. The son doesn't have an opportunity to ask for forgiveness. The son doesn't have an opportunity to say he's going to pay off the debt or anything like that. He has no time to do that. The father forgives the son before he can do anything. Before he can do anything. Before he can clean himself up. The father embraces him. The father, it says, he puts the best robe on him. He's like, get my robe, get the ring, get the sandals, put it on him. Do you know what the best robe was? The best robe was the father's robe. You know that? It was the father's robe. He's saying, I'm going to take my robe, which represents my authority, which represents my standing in the family, and I'm going to put it on this son, on my son. When he puts this robe on the son, he's not just clothing him, but it represents that he's fully accepted back into the family. This isn't just about the fact that he's dirty and naked and needs some clothes. No, he's saying, you are fully accepted back to the family. He puts the signet ring on his finger, right? Representing the authority of the family, the wealth of the family, puts that on his finger, puts sandals on his feet, another signal of wealth. And he does all this before the son can say anything or do anything. He says, you are back in the family. You're back in the family. I will cover your nakedness, your poverty, your rags with the robes of my office and honor. And then he calls in his servants and he says, you know that calf that we've been fattening for that special party that we put on maybe once a year? It's for today. 2,000 years ago, they didn't eat meat very often. Meat was a specialty. You ate meat on special occasions. So they're not just eating meat, they're eating the best meat. The fattened calf was the best they had to offer. He says, the best that we have to offer is for today. And when they'd get the fattened calf, it was fairly large, a lot of meat, and so everybody's invited. The whole village is invited. It's not just a closed family affair, but it's like, invite everybody in. Invite everybody in for this party that we're going to have. The younger son knew that there was abundant food for him to share. That's why he went home. He's like, at least I'm not going to starve. But what he experienced from his dad is that there is abundant grace to share. It wasn't just about surviving, but it's about grace. It's about abundance. You know, sometimes what has been communicated in church in the past is that you make sure you get right with God so that you don't go to hell and you make sure you get into heaven. It's like you don't want to die. You want to live. So make sure you get right with God. And we end up communicating totally the wrong thing. Yes, the Father is saving the Son, but it's not just about survival. It's about abundance. It's not just about survival, it's about abundance. We don't serve Jesus, we don't follow Jesus just to escape some flames of hell. No, we come to the Father because it's just so much better than anything else. It's so much better than anything else. This younger brother, he illustrates the way of self-discovery. In ancient patriarchal societies like the one I'm experiencing, every so often you would have a child that would do this, the way of self-discovery. They would run off and do this. But it was the odd time that someone would do this. Even though Jesus told the story 2,000 years ago, I think this story is almost more relevant for us today. Because we are a culture of self-discovery. We do it more than they did it 2,000 years ago. This paradigm of self-discovery believes that individuals must pursue their own goals. They must be free. You need to self-actualize, regardless of custom or tradition or religion. Any barrier to personal freedom needs to be weakened or removed. What is keeping yourself from being your full self? What is holding you back? What tradition, what religion, what structure? Remove it all away so you can be completely free. In our desire for personal freedom, we've chosen for ourselves what is right and wrong, what is good and beautiful. We have pushed aside and disregarded God, doing things our own way. What did the younger son want most out of life? He wanted the provision of the Father without being held back by the Father. He was saying, God, I want your provision, but you're holding me back. I want to do my own thing. If I can get your provision and do my own thing, I'm going to be so much better. And he was fooling himself, right? I don't know how long it took him, but at some point in time down the road, he recognized that the pathway he was going down, that self-discovery, actually brought him to destruction. He was heading towards death. I think for most of us here today, at some point in time in our lives, we've all gone down this path. If you've been in church for a long time, we read this story and we say, that's those people over there, that's not me. And when we say that, we're actually fooling ourselves. Because this path of self-discovery of saying, God, I want your blessings, but I don't hold me back. We've all done that, haven't we? I've done that. Where I'm like, I'm doing my own thing. God, get out of my way. Get out of my way. The reality is that God and his ways, just like the Father in the story, actually points us towards life and goodness and abundance. And the younger son didn't realize that until he was away from it. Once he was away from it, it's so funny because when I asked you to speak today, Kelly, I had no idea how much it like lined up to this. But your story actually really lines up with his story. It's like, it's not until you're away from it that the younger son realized, oh, actually, that's really good over there. It's really good. And you can even say, like, you know, I'm a Christian. And you can be a Christian and you can still be doing this. You know what? You don't have to go down your own way anymore. God isn't just waiting for you. He actually is wanting to run after you. Jesus told the story because he wants us to understand. He's like, God is like this. If you've had a different version in your mind of who God is, you need to be able to remove that and listen to what Jesus is saying and recognize that this story of this father represents the heart of God. Represents the heart of God. When the son finally goes back to the father, he gives up full control. He's like, I'm actually tired of trying to control my life. And he gives his life back to the father. Do you know that God is your heavenly father? He's a good, good father. He's a good father. And you can actually come underneath his authority and you will discover who you are greater than you'll ever discover on your own. Our culture tells us otherwise, but I believe this story, what Jesus is telling us, is more true than anything we can ever discover. I know it's my story, and I listen to Kelly. I know that's your story, Kelly. That as I came and like came underneath the Father and trusted in him, underneath his authority, it's like I became the greatest version, and I'm still becoming the greatest version of Matt that I can become. I'm still on that journey. And it's the same for each one of you. If you want to become the greatest version of yourself you'll ever become, you're going to find that in Jesus. So will you come home? Will you come home? Because whether or not you've ever considered yourself a Christian or you've ever considered yourself a church person doesn't really matter. Because he still considers you to be a son or a daughter of his. And he's calling out to you and he's saying, come home. Come home. Why don't you close your eyes with me? I just want us to reach out to our Heavenly Father who's here right now. And you might have been a Christian for a long time, been in church, or maybe you're not used to church at all. And you don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to have yourself cleaned up or different things that you're doing completely stopped or however you view it at like this younger son. All you actually have to do is start the journey towards God. And if you start that journey towards God, he will run after you, and he will meet you, and he'll wrap his arms around you. All you do is have to start that journey. And in the heart of hearts, in your heart, saying, Jesus, I'm coming to you. The heart of the Father is greatly shown to us in the fact that he died for us, even when we didn't believe. He took the penalty of everything in our lives, everything that we ever did wrong. And so you just reach out and say, Jesus, thank you for dying for me. Thank you for forgiving me. I believe. I believe. And even in my doubts that I have, help me to believe. I want to start this journey with you. Thank you for accepting me. Thank you for believing in me. Thank you for loving me. Amen. There is going to be people here in this building, I believe, that if you truly reached out to God in that way today, that you need people alongside of you that are going to support you and pray for you and things like that. And so before you leave today, I'd encourage you to grab somebody. There's going to be a few of us up here at the front, prayer team members, that we would love to have that conversation with you, pray with you. And if you don't have a Bible, be able to give you a Bible, which shows you the stories of Jesus. As I wrap up this morning, we see in this story that by bringing the younger brother back into the family, making him an heir of the estate once again. Did you know that this young son has a claim to 1/3 of the inheritance again? This now diminished wealth. And this is going to affect the older brother. The older brother that we're going to be talking about next week, it affects him. And so we're going to be talking about how we can be lost in the way of moral conformity next week. Have an awesome Sunday.